Welcome to the new Cyber Frontier, bringing you the latest news on the local Colorado economy and initiatives that focus on the development of cybersecurity economics. You don't have to be a computer or cybersecurity expert to get plugged in. Your host, Chris Gorog, brings it straightforward, asks the tough questions, and brings the cyber world to a level of understanding for everyone. Chris is personable and opens up with our guests on the issues we all would like to see addressed. You can find us on the web at www.newcyberfrontier.com. Now join our host as he introduces the topic for today's New Cyber Frontier.
My name is Andre Hinton. I'm here with New Cyber Frontier, and we're at Secure Set, where they're allowing us to use their amazing facility. Just want to give them a shout out. And we're here with John Bradshaw. And John, real quick, just tell us a little bit about yourself and who you're representing today and what you do in terms of what's in cybersecurity and what your role is in cyber.
Sure. Good morning, everybody. So, John Bradshaw, I am the Senior Director of Solutions Engineering for Acalvio Technologies, which is a deception-based solution in the cybersecurity world. I have been doing cybersecurity for, I hate to say, about 30 years now. Got into the early days back in the late 80s, early 90s, and have worked at various different security companies, so have gained a lot of knowledge in different disciplines, from network intrusion detection to malware analysis and antivirus capabilities, SIM and event management from a security perspective, and incident response and forensic investigations. Done some time with notable companies like Internet Security Systems, ArcSight, Mandiant, Lastline, and now happy to be here at Acalvio.
Awesome. I tell you what, that's an amazing resume, because and more so because of how long, 30 years. I too have been computing for about 30 years, but over 30 years, but not security, because back 30 years ago, there wasn't a lot going on in terms of securing anything, you know, in terms of globally, you know what I mean? Like, we were computing, but there wasn't a lot of focus around securing data while we're computing. Like, what do you think is the difference between then, you know, 10 years after that, 20 years? Like, how have you seen it evolve since, like, those days? Because I was computing and I never even thought about, but number one, I didn't have a lot of data anyway to protect back 30 years ago. Number two, there just wasn't a lot of focus in most of the realms of computing that I was in those days. In securing anything. So what do you think the difference in the paradigm then and now?
I think one of the biggest things, you know, if I look back at when I first got into this, the organizations that had computing power, that were storing information, were not as prevalent as they are today. I mean, there were not computers in every home. You know, every type of device that you're holding in your hand is wirelessly connected into the internet and is holding data about you, about the places you do business with. And as that computing power and the applications and storage of data has increased exponentially over the time that I've been in this industry, the capabilities of the adversaries to get at that data and the kind of data that they want to steal and then can utilize for economic gain, for financial gain, or for making political statements or, you know, disruption of operations has also increased on that same exponential curve. So, you know, because of that, back when I first started, things were fairly simplistic. You had firewalls, mm-hmm. you had login controls, and maybe you had antivirus at the time, because there were some virus programs starting to come out, but we're nowhere near the level of sophistication that you have today. And when I usually go and do keynotes, especially to like community colleges and stuff, one of the things I tell the up-and-coming people that are studying information security is that today there are as many types of jobs in the cybersecurity industry as there are in the medical industry today. The amount of specialization is just incredible.
Well, I tell you, I echo that. I teach cyber, and I actually teach forensics at a university, and I tell students that all the time who are looking to start something and they don't really know what they want to do, and they're looking for the next hot, you know, job. And a lot of them, I say, well, I'm just going to take business. And I'm like, that's great. But if you're looking to get a job, you know, you might want to look at this hot new industry called cyber. Right?
Yeah, totally agree.
So one of the things
you want to tell, you know, even people that are, you know, studying marketing, you know, being able to convey cyber messages to, in marketing terms, there's excellent careers there because you meet so many people that are unable to translate the bits and bytes and the under the hood that the technical people understand about what adversaries do, but trying to translate that so middle and upper management understand what it is and why it's important. People in marketing, product management, there are all kinds of jobs that are not necessarily forensic investigators or security administrators.
Wow. I'll tell you what, you couldn't have better said that better. because, you know, analytics and things and how those things translate to people and decision makers, they want to hear it, but they want to hear it in layman's terms, but they also want to know how it can affect their bottom line too. You know, I've seen that, you know, day in and day out. Well, here at New Cyber Frontier, real quick, I want to take just a minute for our sponsors. Just a second.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
And we're back here with New Cyber Frontier, and we're on with Mr. Bradshaw. We'll call him John. And yes, sir. And so here at New Cyber Frontier, the main focus is cybersecurity and how and what problems we're facing right now and on the cyber front. And not only what problems, and then one of the things I like to talk about, my name is Andre Hinton, and I'm actually filling in today for Chris Gorog and Abe Thompson, is solutions. I like to spend about 80% of my time working on solutions and 20% on finding out what the challenges are, right? And so in your idea right now and what you're working with your current company, what industry problems are you seeing that we're facing, and then what are some of the solutions that you're working on?
Andrew, one of the things that when I was working at Mandiant, I had the privilege of knowing some of the smartest forensic investigators that I've ever encountered in the industry. And there was one gentleman that taught me a phrase and a concept that I kind of live by with everything that I do in the security world. And that phrase is called prevention failure detection. And the concept is basically that organizations are going to buy security products that are designed to block and prevent an adversary from getting in. Your basic firewall, your malware prevention systems, your proxies, your endpoint threat and remediation systems are all designed to stop the adversary from completing their mission. And if you kind of visualize it, you might think of like a funnel, and you're putting all these different solutions in place to try to narrow the avenues of access that an adversary has into your environment. Now, what you then need to do, and I think this is where some of the problems that organizations are facing today is, you need to focus your teams not on trying to consume all of the information that your prevention mechanisms are telling you, because quite frankly, if they're telling you they blocked an attack, if you're paying attention to that, it's diverting you away from the attack that could possibly be getting through. So this gentleman, you know, taught me to focus efforts on the areas where your prevention can fail, and focus your hunting activities, your investigative activities, and utilizing your team who knows your organization's infrastructure, hopefully better than anybody else, to play the role of the adversary and go, if I was going to breach in to my organization, where are the holes? What could I find? And then from that, of course, learn and correct the issues and mitigate the risk, and then start the whole process over again. And that's why I like where I'm working at today in deception space is basically prevention failure detection. It's basically the assumption that an adversary is going to gain an initial foothold into the environment through a spearfish attack, maybe through a watering hole or drive-by attack, and gain that initial breach point. And from there, they're going to do reconnaissance, they're going to set up additional beachheads, and then they're going to start focusing on mission objective. And the whole purpose of deception is to give you that high-fidelity alert when all of your prevention mechanisms have failed to stop that breach from occurring.
Wow. I'll tell you what, that is a very unique way of looking at it, and I love it. Because it's not, I don't hear that a lot. I do know about prevention, problem, and detection, but I do like that approach. You know, I say a lot of times in my class, because I'm looking for more blind spots. That's what I'm interested in, and I'd also like to talk to you about that a little bit too. And you know, we know what we know. We know what we don't know, but what is it that we don't know that we don't know, right? I mean, that's...
You're doing a Rumsfeld quote there, aren't you? The unknown unknown.
Right. So, you know, one thing that I've noticed over the last, like you said, I've been doing this, and I hate to admit it, I've been computing over 30 years, and once I got involved in information assurance, and there's so much doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results, right? We're just doing the same thing better, right? Expecting to win, you know, and to start winning this cyber warfare, right? And I think that, and I'm not going to take your space, this is your space, and I want to give you a chance to really weigh in on this. What are some of, and real quick before I even go further and we answer that question, we're going to take a second for our sponsors. This is New Cyber Frontier, and we're here at SecureSet at their amazing facility. And we thank them for allowing us to use this facility for this amazing event and New Cyber Frontier podcast.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
Okay, we're back here at our podcast, The New Cyber Frontier, here at SecureSet, where they're allowing us to use their amazing facility. My name is Andre Hinton. I'm filling in for Chris Garag and Abe Thompson. And we're here with John Bradshaw, better known as just John. And the last question I posed was kind of like talking about blind spots and the unknown in terms of cybersecurity Calvio, but your personal experience. Do you know of any blind spots that we can talk about here in this forum?
Inside, we could probably do a month of talking about potential blind spots
right.
in the environment, and a lot of it depends on the organization. A lot of the focus I think, and it's been shifting lately, has been on what I would classify as compute resources, the traditional, the laptop, the workstation, the servers in the server farm. And things have changed so much, especially in the last 5 years or so, and the security practitioners are struggling to keep up with it. You've got IoT devices, you've got everything in your house and in your office wired in, from your environmental controls to your physical security systems to your door lock controls and all of that, and all running on things that have proven to be easily hackable by sophisticated adversaries. You've got industries like the medical field. I just happened to be in the hospital at the beginning of this year, and they had me, wired up to this thing monitoring all my vitals, and it was wirelessly projecting all of my vitals to the nurse's station. Mm-hmm. And it's been shown that all of these medical devices, because of the fact that once they are approved by the FDC, they can't be patched, they can't be modified without losing that certification. So they're very hackable in that situation, and adversaries have successfully used them as pivot points to get to patient data that they are looking for. So you've got all of these areas where it wasn't even believed that hacking could occur. I mean, we've got hackers at DEF CON showing you how to disable automobiles in transit. And because of that, you're having to look at, how am I going to protect something that's on the move, that can't be modified, that can't be patched? And so security teams are having to come up with creative ways of monitoring and isolating those environments, using concepts like zero trust to ensure that these areas are protected as best as possible from these adversaries.
A lot of our listeners here in New Cyber Frontier, they're versed in a lot of cyber, but talk a little bit about zero trust real quick. Just kind of hit on that. You threw it out there and people are like, oh yeah, zero trust. Okay, so give us a little bit of insight on that.
So zero trust at a high level is basically a concept that systems within your environment are only allowed to talk to other systems where they have been giving a certificate, a credentialed access capability. Otherwise, the systems will absolutely refuse to talk to each other. And so what that helps prevent is, if you set the controls up properly in the environment, that you should be able to restrict a lot of the lateral movement that will occur, either from propagating malware, such as ransomware type attacks that are trying to go out and infect as many systems as possible, or the human-based adversary that, again, gains that initial toehold in the system, and they want to get administrative credential access, they want to pop the Active Directory server and gain a better look at the environment, and then ultimately they want to pivot to their mission objective, which might be like the database server holding the financial data or the personnel records or whatever it is they're looking for. In zero trust world, those type of lateral moves would be heavily restricted because those systems are not designated to be able to talk to those type of systems in that manner.
Is there a concern with actually, performance degradation when you use that zero trust in some environments? Because I've heard, decision makers make that, argument, hey, is it going to work? Am I going to lose communication between these devices? This is a risk. And there's all kinds of risks. There's moderate, high and low risk to these things happening and tolerance. So how and if the zero trust could affect that?
I think it's the same age-old problem we had when firewalls first emerged onto the market. And the stories you may have heard, people would plug the firewall in and wonder why they were still getting attacked. Well, they didn't go in and change the default rule of permit any.
Right.
They just thought you plugged the thing in and it did its
job.
Worked. Zero trust follows kind of that same rule of the road. This is not something you just can plug in and expect it to work. You've got to define what the communication allowed paths are, and then make sure that your administrative teams are setting them up correctly. So obviously, a lot of QA should be done so that you don't cause a self-inflicted denial of service attack. But when implemented properly, and it's not like you necessarily have to go right out and do everything all at once, but you start going, okay, my database servers, what should be talking to the database servers? Well, my front-end web application server and my database administrators are the natural two that would be the first on the list. So when you start building those relationships out, defining this zero trust model starts to make more sense.
Yeah, that's I've worked in an environment at Lockheed Martin, and not to talk about Lockheed Martin, but it's a company. And in that database, there were things that were pulling data off the database, and you know, when you start putting controls on that and you don't know which, like say for instance, there's an application that needs this particular data type and it's pulling that data, and then you put some type of control on it that way, I think you're gonna have to have some testing involved before you just outright just apply something like that in a zero trust environment.
Well, and the scary part is that a lot of times the administrators don't know who's, you know, yes, there are a lot of people legitimately pulling data out of the databases, but they don't know it. So how do they know who's the legitimate pull and who's the malicious pull?
Right. That's, wow. I'll tell you what, I have never worked in that zero trust environment. I'm interested in actually looking at that myself. We'll talk a little bit more. Right now, we're going to go to our sponsors. This is New Cyber Frontier. I'm here at... my name is Andre Hinton. I'm filling in for Chris Gorog and Abe Thompson here at SecureSet, this amazing, beautiful facility they're allowing us to use. Thank you very much. Here's our sponsor.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
And I'm here with New Cyber Frontier, and I'm here at SecureSet. My name is Andre Hinton. I'm filling in for Chris Gorog and Abe Thompson. I appreciate the opportunity, and we're here with John of Acalvio. And we're talking on the last topic about zero trust, which we kind of got down this rabbit hole and we can't get out of it because it's pretty amazing, right? So I wanted to talk to you a little bit, John, about how zero trust can affect individuals. Like, how can I use zero trust at home? Like, how can it, can I use it somehow in my own personal life? And those out there who are listening.
Yeah, and I kind of do the same thing in my home network. Blessed and both cursed with four teenage boys growing up very close in age, you can imagine that I had to put some fairly restrictive controls in my home network environment to make sure, one, they didn't get me owned in the process, and two, they weren't going to places that teenage boys shouldn't be going to. So again, originally when set out when they were younger in middle school, I basically had policies put in place that they could not connect out to any system on the internet that I had not already pre-approved.
Okay.
And you know, that was kind of a great control because it, I also had audio alarms built in that told me every time they tried to go somewhere that wasn't on the pre-approved list. And
cool.
It was pretty funny to hear them upstairs, quote unquote, doing their homework, and I'd hear the audio alarms go off and I'd go up and kind of chastise them for not focusing on schoolwork. But you know, and it's kind of the same principles. It's harder to do, I think, with an organization with their staff, because you've got that balance, and this has kind of opened up the can of worms and makes zero trust at the end user workstation, I think, more difficult, because the end users, they want to go to their social media, they want to go to their Snapchat, their Facebook, their Netflix, and all these places to do their shopping and check in on their friends and all of that. And that creates a lot of opportunities for the drive-bys, for the watering hole attacks, and for any type of social engineering against certain users, where a sophisticated adversary can gain access to their credentials or to their system, and that gives the adversary initial toehold in the environment. And then that's where, if the zero trust model is not fully implemented or implemented properly, a highly sophisticated adversary is going to take their time, be patient, and they're going to wiggle their way through and figure out where the weaknesses are.
Excellent. I'll tell you what, John, I'm not the one who's in charge of this. It's Chris Gorog. But I think it's not fair that we don't have you back on this show, because thank you for giving us as much information as you have, especially when it comes to a zero trust. You know, we kind of got down that rabbit hole, and I wanted to get so much more information from you, because I know you have a whole lot more to share with us. But what you did was extremely valuable, you know, in that interim, because not a lot of people are talking about zero trust. Myself and Chris are really all over that in the way of blockchain technology, because there's a way to get that same type of zero trust through blockchain. I don't know if you've worked with any of the blockchain technology at all, but that's kind of its basis as
not
well.
Yet.
Is yeah. So you may want to just kind of tune into a lot of our podcasts. They are kind of driven towards a lot of our blockchain technology. Chris Gorog's probably one of the leading resources in blockchain research. He's been doing probably over 20 years of blockchain research himself, and there's not many people in the industry who've done that. So he's a really good resource for that. But my name is Andre Hinton. I'm here filling in at New Cyber Frontier. We're here with John Bradshaw from Acalvia. Do you have any information, number one, on your company that you'd like to share? How to get in touch with you if there's listeners out there that need to get in touch with you and your services?
So absolutely. So like as we said, Acalvia is a company that specializes in deception-based technologies. We are focusing our efforts on minimal deployment, both in cloud, on-prem. We can do it with zero hardware deployment if customers desire. We can go hybrid. And we pride ourselves in having a lot of patents around fully automating the deception process. So, as much hands-off, what I usually like to call fewest number of mouse clicks required to get the job done. But they can certainly look us up at our website, www.acalvio, that's acalvio.com. And of course, I'm john@acalvio.com if they want to contact me directly for any questions on our product or any other security topics I'm happy to assist with. And hopefully we'll hear from them.
Thank you for the time you did spend with us today. Once again, this is John Bradshaw from Acalvio. My name is Andre Hinton. I'm filling in for Chris Gorog and Abe Thompson here at New Cyber Frontier. And we're here in Secure Set building and an amazing facility here. I've got coffee. I've got bagels. I wish you all could come down here and join me. So anyway, have a great day. Thank you, John.
The views or opinions expressed during this podcast are not those of Colorado Technical University.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of New Cyber Frontier. Remember to get involved. Often we think that someone else will handle privacy and security in the virtual world, but you are the only one truly in command of your virtual fate. Join our mailing list so we can keep you informed of breaking news and new releases. If you have an idea, if you have a question that you would like to hear answered, or if you want to get involved with our efforts, reach out to us at newcyberfrontier.com. We also encourage you to visit our sponsors' links, as they are the ones that really make this show possible. I want to thank each of you for supporting the show, and we look forward to seeing you back for the next episode of New Cyber Frontier.